This is Audible.
The Noticer by Andy Andrews. Sometimes all a person needs is a little perspective. The Noticer is published by Thomas Nelson Incorporated and read by the author.
Chapter 1. His name was Jones. At least that's what I called him. Not Mr. Jones, just Jones. He called me young man or son, and I rarely heard him call anyone else by name either. It was always young man or young lady, child or son. He was old, but the kind of old that is difficult to quantify. Was he 65 or 80? Or 180? And every single time I ever laid eyes on him, he had an old brown suitcase close at hand. Me? I was 23 when I saw him for the first time. He held out his hand, and for some reason, I took it. Looking back on the moment, I think that act in itself was a small miracle. Any other time, and with any other person, considering my circumstances, I might have cowered in fear or come out with my fist flying. I had been crying, and he heard me, I guess. My cries were not the muffled sobs of loneliness or the whimpering of discomfort, though certainly I was lonely and uncomfortable, but the anguished wail that a guy will let loose only when he is sure there is no one around to hear him. And I was sure. Wrong, obviously, but sure. At least as sure as one spending another night under a pier can be. My mother had succumbed to cancer several years earlier, a tragic event in my life which was compounded shortly thereafter by my father, who, neglecting to wear his seatbelt, managed to chase my mother into the afterlife by way of an otherwise survivable automobile accident. One questionable decision followed another during the confused aftermath of what I saw as my abandonment, and within a couple of years I found myself on the Gulf Coast, without a home, a vehicle, or the financial means to obtain either. I did odd jobs, mostly cleaning fish on the piers or selling bait to the tourists, and showered at the beach or swam myself clean in a pool at one of the hotels. If it was cold, there was always a garage left open in one of the many empty vacation homes that dotted the beach. Rich people, anyone who owned a vacation home, I soon learned, often had an extra refrigerator or freezer hooked up in their garage. Not only were these excellent sources of old lunch meat and drinks, but they also worked almost as well as a heater if I lay close to the warm air that blew from the fan at the bottom. Most nights, though, I much preferred my home underneath the Gulf State Park pier. I had a large hole dug in and smoothed out, right where the concrete met the sand. Visualize a monstrous lean-to. It was roomy, absolutely hidden from view, and as dry as anything ever is at the beach. I left my few belongings there, mostly fishing tackle, T-shirts, and shorts, often for days at a time, and never had anything stolen. Honestly, I didn't think anyone knew I slept there, which is why I was so surprised when I looked up and saw Jones. "Come here, son," he said, with his hand outstretched. "Move into the light." I shuffled forward, taking his right hand with my own, and eased into the soft glow cast from the sodium vapor bulbs above the pier. Jones was not a large man, nowhere near 6 feet, but neither was he small. His white hair was worn straight back over his head. It was too long, but it had been carefully brushed and smoothed with his fingertips. His eyes, even in the dim light, seemed to shine. They were a clear crystal blue, framed by a deeply wrinkled face. He wore jeans, a white T-shirt, and leather flip-flops. The old man seemed stately, though, even now, I admit that is hardly a word one would use to describe a 5'9" or so old man under a pier at night. As I describe Jones, I might as well go ahead and tell you that I never knew whether he was black or white. I'm not sure it matters beyond trying to paint a mental picture for you, but I never asked and never decided if his café au lait colored skin was the result of genetics or a life lived mostly outdoors. In any case, he was brown. Sort of. "You crying about something in particular?" he asked. "Maybe somebody in particular?" "Yeah," I thought. "Me. I am the somebody in particular." "Are you going to rob me?" I asked aloud. It was an odd question. More evidence, I suppose, of the level of distrust I had in everyone and everything at that time. The old man's eyebrows rose. Peering beyond me into the darkness from which I had emerged moments before, he chuckled. "Rob you? I don't know. You got some furniture or a TV in there I didn't see?" I didn't respond. I might have hung my head. Somehow his attempt at humor made me feel worse. Not that he seemed to care. He punched me playfully on the arm. "Lighten up, young man," he said. "First of all, you're about a foot and a half taller than me, so no, I'm not about to rob you. Second, there is a benefit of not owning a bunch of stuff." I looked at him blankly. So he went on. "You're safe. Not only am I not going to rob you, neither is anybody else. You've got nothing to take." He paused, aware that I was still not smiling. In fact, quite the opposite. I was becoming angry. The old man changed tack. "Hey, Andy, if I promise not to ever rob you, can I have one of the cokes you have stashed back in there?" He gestured behind me. I stared at him. "Yes? No?" he said. "Please?" "How did you know my name?" I asked. "You can call me Jones, by the way." "Okay, so how did you know my name, and how do you know whether or not I have any cokes under there?" "No big deal, really," he shrugged. "I've been watching you for a long time. I've been around. And the cokes are bound to be a product of your late-night forays into the garages of the local rich and famous, so can I have one?" I watched him for a moment, considering his answer, then slowly nodded and retreated into the darkness for his coke. Returning with two cans, I handed one to the old man. "Didn't shake it up, did you?" He grinned. Then, seeing that once again I refused even the slightest smile, he sighed and said, "Lord, Lord, you are a tough one." Popping the top on the coke, Jones shifted in the sand and crossed his legs. "All right," he said, taking a long pull from the red can. "Let's get started." "Get started at what?" I asked flatly. Jones set his drink can down and said, "We need to start noticing a few things. We need to check your heart. We need to gather a little perspective." "I don't even know what you're talking about," I said, "and I don't even know who you are." "Fair enough," he smiled. "Well, let me see now. How do I explain?" He leaned toward me quickly. "As for who I am, call me Jones."
"You already told me that," I interrupted.
"What I mean..." "Yeah, I know what you mean. You mean where'd I come from and stuff like that."
I nodded.
"Well, this evening I came from just up the beach a ways."
I sighed and rolled my eyes. Chuckling, he held up both hands in mock protest.
"Hang on, hang on now. Don't get aggravated, old Jones."
In a softer voice, he added, "Okay?" Accepting my nod, he continued.
"I am a noticer," he said. "It is my gift. While others may be able to sing well or run fast, I notice things that other people overlook. And you know, most of them are in plain sight."
The old man leaned back on his hands and cocked his head.
"I notice things about situations and people that produce perspective. That's what most folks lack, perspective, a broader view. So I give them that broader view, and it allows them to regroup, take a breath, and begin their lives again."
For several minutes we sat there quietly, peering out at the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. I was strangely calm in the presence of this old man, who was now lying on his side, elbow in the sand, with his head propped on his hand. After a while, he spoke again, a question this time.
"So, your mom and daddy passed on?"
"How did you know that?" I asked in return. He gave the tiniest of shrugs, as if to say, "Everybody knows, but I knew they didn't." Though it alarmed me that this stranger seemed to know so much about me, I shook off the eerie feeling and answered his question.
"Yeah, they're both dead."
He pursed his lips.
"Well, that's a matter of perspective, too."
When I questioned him with a look, he continued,
"There's a big difference in dead and passed on."
"Not to me," I snorted.
"You ain't the one who's passed on."
"You got that right," I said bitterly. "I'm the one who's left." On the verge of tears again, and with a mean tone of voice, I blurted out, "So what's your perspective on that, huh?"
Carefully, Jones asked, "Well, why do you think you're here?" in this situation, in this place, I mean. Because I chose to be, I tossed out. My own bad decisions, my attitude. I stared hard at him. See, I know all the right answers, so I don't need to hear it from you. It's all my fault, okay? Is that what you want me to say?
No, the old man said calmly. I was just curious if you had any perspective of your own.
Well, no, I don't, I said. I grew up hearing that old adage about God putting a person after his own heart where he wants him to be, and he puts me under a pier? I cursed, then added, by the way, about that reference to the difference between dead and passed on, I've spent more than enough of my life in church, so I get what you're implying. I'm just not sure I buy any of that anymore.
That's okay for the moment, Jones said soothingly. I hear you, and I understand why you feel that way. But listen, I'm not selling anything. Remember, I am only here for perspective.
Yeah, I know. Jones was silent for a time, and I began to wonder if I had been rude enough to shut him down completely. But no, that was just the first of several chances I would offer him to give up on me and leave, and he didn't.
Young man, Jones asked as he brushed a wisp of white hair from his eyes, what would you think if I told you that, yes, your bad choices and decisions have had a part in your ending up under this pier? But beyond that, under this pier is exactly where you should be in order for a future to occur that you can't even imagine at this point.
I don't understand, I said, and I'm not sure I would believe it if I did.
You will, Jones replied. Trust me, one day you will.
Then suddenly smiling, he said, here's the thing, son. Everybody seems to misunderstand that saying you threw at me a minute ago. Why does everyone think that when people say God will put a person after his own heart where he wants him to be, that it means God will put them on a mountaintop or in a big house or at the front of the line? Think with me here. Everybody wants to be on the mountaintop, but if you'll remember, mountaintops are rocky and cold. There is no growth on the top of a mountain. Sure, the view is great, but what's a view for? A view just gives us the glimpse of our next destination, our next target. But to hit that target, we must come off the mountain, go through the valley, and begin to climb the next slope. It is in the valley that we slog through the lush grass and rich soil, learning and becoming what enables us to summit life's next peak. So my contention is that you are right where you are supposed to be. The old man scooped up a double handful of the white sand and let it pour from his fingers. It may look like barren sand to you, son, but nothing could be further from the truth. I say to you that as you lay your head down tonight, you are sleeping on fertile ground. Think, learn, pray, plan, dream, for soon you will become. Before he left that night, Jones opened his suitcase, holding it carefully away from my curious gaze, and removed three small, orange, hardcover books.
"Do you read?" he asked. As I nodded, he added, "I'm not asking if you can read, I'm asking if you do."
"Yes," I responded, "mostly magazines and stuff, but I do."
"Good enough," Jones said. "Read these."
I looked at what he had handed me in the semi-darkness. The titles were all names: Winston Churchill, Will Rogers, George Washington Carver. I glanced back up at him.
"History books?"
"No," he said with a twinkle in his eye.
"Adventure stories. Success, failure, romance, intrigue, tragedy, and triumph. And the best part is that every word is true. Remember, young man, experience is not the best teacher. Other people's experience is the best teacher. By reading about the lives of great people, you can unlock the secrets to what made them great."
I read Winston Churchill until dawn. It was comforting somehow to discover a life that had endured more tragedy and rejection than my own. And it didn't escape me that by the end of his life, Churchill had met with more than an equal measure of success. Jones had said goodbye sometime after I started reading. I barely noticed him leave, but in the morning I wished I had been nicer to the old man. I felt embarrassed, a bit ashamed of myself, but not nearly so devoid of hope as I had been the evening before.
By nightfall, I had finished George Washington Carver and was so tired that I slept until the next morning. That day, I washed boats at the marina and thought constantly about what I'd read. I also kept an eye out for Jones, but I didn't see him. Gene, the marina manager, said he knew Jones well. He told me the old man had been coming through town for years. In fact, Gene said, Jones was old when I was a boy, and I'm 52. I read Will Rogers within the next 24 hours, but it wasn't until several days later that I saw my friend again. I was throwing a cast net in the lagoon, trying to catch shrimp and mullet minnows to sell for bait, when the old man slipped up behind me. "Doing any good?" he asked. "Hey, Jones," I exclaimed. "I didn't hear you come up. Where have you been? I've already read the books." He chortled at my enthusiasm. Actually, I was a bit surprised myself that I was so glad to see him. "Slow down, slow down. Let me comment," he grinned. "You didn't hear me come up because you were splashing around so much you wouldn't have heard me if I was riding an elephant. As for where I've been, I've been around. Even seen you a couple of times, but didn't want to be a bother. I'm glad you finished the books. Like them?"
"Yes, sir," I answered breathlessly. "I really did."
"Good. I figured you were through with all three by now. I hope you don't mind. I stopped by the pier and got them. And I left three more."
"Really?" I said, surprised.
"Thanks." "You're welcome. I'm getting them from the library, but I'm picking them out special for you." Jones then held up a plastic bag. "You hungry? I got lunch."
"I'm always hungry," I said. Lately, I've been a one-meal-a-day kind of guy, or what my mom used to call an opportunistic eater.
"Well, come on," he said. "Get out of the water. I have a feast."
The feast turned out to be Vienna sausages and sardines. I was hungry, so I ate, but I wasn't exactly thrilled with the fare, and Jones knew it. I wondered later if that's why he brought it in the first place. We had settled under an oak tree on a high dune, the beach in front of us and the deep blue lagoon at our backs. I wore old tennis shoes, blue jean cutoffs, and no shirt. Jones, in his usual casual attire, had coiled a blue bandana around his head. The blue of that headband seemed to make his eyes glow. From where we sat, we could hear the crashing of the surf, and there was just enough breeze to make the summer temperature bearable.
"So what are you eating?" Jones asked, peering at me with a smile.
I looked up, puzzled. Wiping my mouth with the back of my hand, I swallowed and said,
"What?
You know what I'm eating. Same as you."
"Really?"
the old man teased with a sly look.
"Somehow I doubt it. But let's see."
He leaned over to glance at my food, then looked back at me.
"What are you eating?" he asked again. "And where are you eating it?"
Seeing that I was now more confused than ever, he added gently, "It's not a trick. Just answer the questions." I raised my eyebrows and said, "Well." I held up my hands as if to say, "I still don't know what you're getting at," and I said,
"I guess I'm..." "No, don't guess. Just tell me."
"Okay.
I'm eating sardines and Vienna sausages."
"Where?"
"In the sand."
Jones smiled.
"I thought so."
Nodding then, he said again,
"I thought so. Well, the books will help, but I believe I can help as well."
"Jones," I said, shaking my head, "what are you talking about?"
"Your vision, my boy. It is incredibly cloudy at the moment, but I am certain we can clear a pathway from your head to your heart and into your future."
I was frustrated but curious. "I still don't understand." Jones put his hand on my shoulder and said,
"I know you don't, and I wouldn't expect you to understand."
He leaned close to me.
"Because you lack perspective."
He laughed at the expression on my face, but continued,
"Young man, you see only the sand at your feet and what you're eating that you wish was something else. I don't tell you this as a rebuke. You're very ordinary in your views. Most people are just like you, disgusted with themselves for what they are and what they eat and what they drive. Most of us never stop to think there are quite literally millions in this world who lack our blessings and opportunities, have no food to eat at all, and no hope of ever owning a car. The situation in which you find yourself is fraught with difficulty. Yes, it is also piled high with benefits."
Jones paused to ponder a thought, narrowed his eyes, then said,
Here for you, young man, is a law of the universe, one of many, to be sure, but one that is especially applicable to your life at present. Remember, whatever you focus upon increases. I frowned, trying to grasp the meaning of his words. Fortunately, Jones didn't leave me guessing. When you focus on the things you need, he went on to explain, you'll find those needs increasing. If you concentrate your thoughts on what you don't have, you will soon be concentrating on other things that you've forgotten that you don't have and feel worse. If you set your mind on loss, you are more likely to lose. But a grateful perspective brings happiness and abundance into a person's life. Joan saw the doubt on my face. He put his cans aside and shifted his body to face me directly. "Consider this. When we are happy and enthusiastic," he said, "other people enjoy being around us. True?" "I guess," I answered. "No guesses," Jones chided. "When we are happy and enthusiastic, other people enjoy being around us. Yes or no?"
"Yes."
"And knowing that one's opportunities and encouragement come from other people, what happens to a person everyone enjoys being around?"
I was beginning to catch on. "They get more opportunities and encouragement?" I ventured.
"That is correct," Jones affirmed. "And what happens to a life filled with opportunities and encouragement?"
As I opened my mouth to speak, the old man answered for me.
"A life filled with opportunities and encouragement finds more and more opportunities and encouragement, and success becomes inevitable."
Seeing the hope and a new understanding in my expression, Jones held up a finger.
"I must caution you, however," he said, "that the opposite of this principle is true as well. When a person is negative, complaining, and disagreeable, other people stay away, and that person receives less encouragement and fewer opportunities because no one wants to be around him. And we know what happens to a life without opportunities and encouragement. Things get worse and worse," I answered.
Jones paused a moment to let the truth of my last realization sink in. Then he offered a plan of action.
"So how does one become a person whom other people want to be around? Let me make a suggestion. Ask yourself this question every day. What is it about me that other people would change if they could?"
Thinking for a moment, I had a question of my own. "Jones, what if I get an answer about something that I don't want to change?" The old man tittered and replied,
"The question wasn't about you in the first place. The question was, what would other people change about you if they could?"
Sensing my uncertainty, he explained,
"Look, son, I'm not saying that you should live your life according to the whims of others. I am simply pointing out that if you are to become a person of influence, if you want people to believe the things you believe or buy what you are selling, then others must at least be comfortable around you. A successful life has a great deal to do with perspective. And another person's perspective about you can sometimes be as important as your perspective is about yourself."
For several minutes, we both sat silently, watching the gulls soar overhead, listening to the surf break on the beach. Then Jones began to gather the empty cans and place them in the plastic bag. Standing, he extended his hand and helped me to my feet.
"Incidentally," he said with a smirk, "you ate sardines and Vienna sausages in the sand. I dined on surf and turf with an ocean view."
He slapped me on the back.
"It's all about perspective."
Later that day, I crawled back into my home under the pier. Laid neatly on my tackle box were three more orange books. Again, they were all biographies: Joan of Arc, Abraham Lincoln, Viktor Frankl. I picked up the Frankl book first. I was unfamiliar with him. The book was titled Man's Search for Meaning. As I skimmed through, I learned that Frankl was an Austrian psychiatrist who survived the Nazi death camps during World War II. His wife, father, and mother were all murdered. It's all about perspective.
I could hear Joan's voice rattling around in my head. Suddenly I noticed there was a piece of paper folded into the book. As I removed it, I could see that it was a napkin. On it, Jones had written, "Young man, read this one first. I am proud of you. Jones." Tears filled my eyes as I carefully placed the letter back into the book. It had been a long time since anyone had been proud of me. Today, I can remember distinctly that the next three books were Harry Truman, Florence Nightingale, and King David. Then I was given Harriet Tubman, Queen Elizabeth I, and John Adams. Numbers 13, 14, and 15 were Eleanor Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and Joshua Chamberlain. Tucked into the Chamberlain book was a note from Jones, simply instructing me to please return these last three to the library myself, which I did, and I checked out George Washington, Anne Frank, and Christopher Columbus on my own. It wasn't long before I noticed that Jones had gone. I looked for him for weeks, finding evidence of his having been around at every turn. Jones had arranged for Nancy, the owner of Sea and Suds, a restaurant on the beach, to fry any fish I brought in. Hush puppies and iced tea were included in my special price. Along with all the crackers I could eat, the price was a dollar. Soon more charter boat captains began giving me their boats to wash, and in some cases their clients' fish to clean. Every single time, Jones' name was mentioned. One day, Brent Burns, a songwriter performing at the Holiday Inn, told me that an old man had informed him that I was funny and had suggested that I might do some comedy during his breaks. "Could I?" he asked. I did. And though I was probably not very good, Brent laughed at my material several times a week and encouraged me with his words and an occasional meal. The next several years were a blur. I continued to read biographies even though the pier was no longer my shelter. Through the influence of General George Patton, Madame Curie, Joshua, Caleb, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Alexander the Great, Booker T. Washington, Daniel Boone, and eventually more than 200 other biographies, I had begun to move my life in a forward direction. At some point during that time, a crystallizing moment occurred as I read yet another account of the life of some influential, financially secure, highly successful person. I realized that a graph had formed in my mind, unconsciously identifying seven things that these great people all had in common, seven principles they had all employed. And I wondered, what would happen to my life if I harnessed the power of these seven principles? After all, I reasoned, principles work every time. And they work whether I understand them or not. The principle of gravity was working long before the apple ever fell on Newton's head. Yet when that apple finally did fall and Newton understood the principle behind it, society was then free to harness that principle to fly airplanes, build suspension bridges, and a host of other things. Continuing this line of thought, I became convinced that the principles of personal success in parenting, finances, leadership, and relationships are no different from the principle of gravity. And since they do work every time, and they work whether or not I know them, I concluded, why shouldn't I harness them and apply them in my daily life to create the future God wants for me? So I did. My life today, the well-being of my family, and whatever success we have enjoyed have been the direct result of the power of seven simple principles. Several years ago, I shared these principles with the world in a book that became a New York Times bestseller and has since been translated into more than 20 languages. The Traveler's Gift is now used by corporations, teams, governments, and individuals all over the globe. The Traveler's Gift is a story about a family enduring a tragic period in their lives. As the story progresses, the father, David Ponder, is allowed to travel through time, meeting with seven historic individuals who are also experiencing turmoil and hardship. These people, among them Harry Truman, Anne Frank, Abraham Lincoln, King Solomon, and Columbus, each give Ponder a separate principle to incorporate into his life. And because of these seven principles, his life is changed forever. So if you have ever heard me speak at a corporate event, or read any of my books and wondered how I came to read more than 200 biographies, books that led me to seven principles,
Now you know. It was an old man named Jones who took an interest in, or pity on, a young man going through the worst time in his life. I have thought of Jones every single day now for almost 25 years. On the day I was married, I had hoped he would be there. I wanted him to sit in the first row, where my father would have been. When each of my boys was born, I walked outside the hospital alone, in the half-light of an early morning, hoping to find Jones waiting, smiling, ready with advice and comfort about my future as a father. There have been so many times I've wished for just an hour alone with that old man. But I never saw him again. Until last week. Chapter 2. To tell the truth, I'd been doing a double take at every white-haired old man I'd seen for more than 2 decades, hoping it was Jones, but I was always disappointed. I tried to tell myself that it didn't make sense. He was an old man then. How much older would he be by now? I finally decided that Jones was no longer alive. Couldn't be. But then, last Thursday, just past noon, I was in C. and Sud's, the same restaurant I used to visit for a dollar. It is still owned by Nancy and still my lunch place, even though she charges me full price now. I was eating a shrimp sandwich at the oyster bar and teasing Willie, who was shucking oysters, when Nancy walked over. "Hi, Nancy," I said. "Hi yourself," she replied with a smile. "Is Willie bothering you?" "Yes," I said, laughing. "Willie's always bothering me." "Come on now," Willie protested as he popped another oyster open and put it on a plate. "Be good to Willie. There's plenty of nice people waiting for that stool." We laughed, but as I looked around, I could see he was right. Spring break was in full swing, and in Gulf Shores, that meant the little restaurant overlooking the water was packed. There were even people sitting outside, waiting for a table or for room to open up at the bar. "It's good to see your buddy again," Nancy said. "Do you want some more iced tea?" "Thanks," I said, pushing the plastic glass across to her. "What buddy? Who'd you see?" "Jones," she answered, nodding her head to a point somewhere behind me. "He came in a few minutes ago with Jan and Barry Hansen." Nancy saw the stunned expression on my face, maybe the beginning of tears in my eyes, as I quickly searched the restaurant, and she offered an awkward apology. "I'm sorry I didn't say anything when he came in. I guess he didn't see you either. You have your back to the door. I just assumed you two were, you know, together." I spotted him at the southwest corner table, with his back to me, but there was no mistaking all that white hair and the brown suitcase on the floor beside him. It was Jones. I had to stop myself from running across the restaurant and yelling his name. "How long has it been since he was here?" Nancy asked. "Seems like forever, but he sure looks the same." He did look the same. His hair was cut a bit shorter, perhaps, but not much. It was still worn a bit carelessly, and it was still in jeans. Even the leather flip-flops looked like the same ones, but surely they weren't. I eased gingerly between the tables, moving to see him from the side before I approached. After all this time, I still couldn't believe it was him. Jan and Barry, a couple I knew, saw me first, and Barry stood, calling my name and greeting. It was obvious I was headed for their table, and I suppose they assumed I wanted to talk to them. And any other time I would have. This time, however, I was in some degree of shock, and they were not my object of interest. I came closer, and despite the loud voices all around us, quietly said, "Jones?" He turned and smiled. "Oh, man," I said, sinking to my knees in order to hug him before he could even get up. "I can't believe it's you! I can't... Where have you been? I thought maybe you were dead, or... I'm so... Hey, I have a wife and 2 boys!" I know, he said as he hugged me. "Slow down. We have plenty of time to talk." I was suddenly embarrassed, realizing that several people around us were looking. Even the Hansons seemed ill at ease, though for some reason I didn't feel it had anything to do with me. "Do you know each other?" Jan asked. Considering the circumstances, it was one of the dumber questions I've heard in my life, but I felt it was not my place to tell her at that moment. Normally, "No, I do this to every old man I see," is what I would have said, but just this once I kept my sarcasm buttoned down and managed a simple, "Yes." Then I added, Jones is the single person on this planet most responsible for my... I met Andy when he was a much younger man, Jones interrupted forcefully, but in a cheerful voice. Addressing me then, he said with a chuckle, You're not quite as skinny as you used to be. No, sir, I responded. I eat a little more regularly now. Good food? He asked with a twinkle in his eyes. Jones, it's all surf and turf with an ocean view. Good man, he said as he reached out and squeezed my arm. Can I meet you somewhere later? I was suddenly aware that Jan and Barry were looking extremely uncomfortable, though for the life of me I couldn't imagine why. Yes, sure, I said. Do you want me to wait outside, or... I gestured a whatever you want me to do with my hands. Tell you what, Jones said. I want to talk to my new best friends a bit. Meet me at our old place in a couple of hours, but on top of the pier this time, okay? He winked at me. I think I'll impose on these fine folks to drop me off, or maybe they'll walk me there. The Gulf State Park Pier, my old home, was only a mile or so up the beach. In fact, we could see it from Seeing Suds. Sounds good, I answered. See you in a couple hours, then. As I said goodbye to the Hansons, I couldn't help but notice again that they, Barry especially, looked as if they were about to bolt. And had Jones said they were his new best friends? What did that mean? 45 minutes earlier, Barry Hanson had walked out of his attorney's office in a daze. After 21 years of marriage, Jan had filed for divorce. She still loved him. She just didn't like him anymore. She didn't feel loved, she had said. Barry was the president of the local branch of the state's largest bank. He made a good salary and had saved wisely, and while not what one might call rich, his family was debt-free and very comfortable. He was an active member of several civic organizations and served on 2 committees at his church. Furthermore, by all accounts, Barry was a great father to his 2 children, Elizabeth, 14, and Jared, 10. Jan stopped teaching full-time when Jared was born and directed her energy toward Barry, their children, and volunteer work in the Gulf Shores, Orange Beach area. She was slender, wore her dark hair short, and was one of the more popular ladies in the community. Jan also sang in the Coastal Chorale, an auditioned community choir. Jan and Barry were the same age, 43, and had attended the same university, though they had not met until 2 years after graduation, at the wedding of a mutual friend. They fell madly in love, couldn't imagine an hour, let alone their whole lives, without each other, and were married within the year. Now Barry could not imagine what had gone wrong. He loved Jan. He had always loved her, though from time to time he grew irritated at her because she never seemed to believe it. How many times had he said, I love you, or you're beautiful, only to see her eyes narrow in suspicion or tear up in disbelief? Privately, it drove him nuts, but he did love her. And now this? Divorce? He could hardly believe it. It was almost noon. As Jan moved through the house, picking up here and there, she kept an eye on the clock. She was meeting Barry for lunch, perhaps for the last time. No, that wasn't true, she told herself. There were the children to consider. She had told him she wanted a divorce 2 days ago, and neither of them had slept since. Gathering her purse and keys, Jan walked out onto their front porch and locked the door behind her. As she moved toward the steps, she paused, almost stopped, and shook her head at the holly bush that had threatened to overgrow the sidewalk in front of her. Wiping tears from her eyes, Jan set her jaw and strode purposefully to the car. For more than a year, she had mentioned that holly bush to her husband. But had he trimmed it? No, he had not. Neither had he fixed the back screen door or painted the carport like she had asked. Jan backed the car out onto the street, put the car in drive, accelerated, and immediately slammed on the brakes. There was an old man in front of her. She had not hit him, had not even come close, but it scared the daylights out of her. It was Jones, the old man who wandered in and out of town every now and then. He had been doing something at the Shearsons' house down the street for several days, and she had noticed him walking through the neighborhood the afternoon before. Jan had never talked to the old man, but she knew quite a few people who had, and everyone, as far as she knew, loved him. "I am so sorry," he said as he came around to the driver's side window. I didn't mean to scare you. I tried to get your attention as you were backing up.
Oh, gosh, Jan said, catching her breath. I'm sorry, too. I guess I wasn't paying attention like I should have. I'm just, well, I have some other things on my mind. Did you want something?
Yes, the old man smiled. May I ask if you're headed to the beach?
Jan nodded hesitantly as he continued.
I don't mean to impose, but could I have a ride? I'm afraid I'm going to be late for a lunch appointment.
He paused, noticing her indecision, then with a tilt of his head and an expression of humility, added, Please? Ordinarily, Jan wouldn't have given a ride to anyone she didn't know, not in a million years. But this old man seemed safe.
Okay, she said, wondering vaguely what Barry would say about her giving a ride to a stranger, then decided it didn't matter anymore. Hop in. Do you need to put your suitcase in the trunk?
No, Jones answered as he quickly got in the passenger side. It's small. I could just hold it in my lap. We're only a couple of minutes away from the restaurant. I'm eating at C and Sud's, by the way, if you're going anywhere in the vicinity.
Jan tried to smile, but it came off as a grimace. She said simply, In fact, I'm going there myself.
Good, good, the old man said enthusiastically. Then I'm not too much trouble. I'm meeting my best friend there.
Jan grunted a response, then, because she felt as though she had to say something, said, You're Mr. Jones, aren't you?
No Mr. to it, he replied, just Jones. And you are Jan Hansen, am I right?
Yes, Jan nodded as her eyebrows rose. I am. Have we met?
No, Jones laughed. We haven't, but you are Barry Hansen's wife, and Barry is my best friend.
Jan said nothing as she pulled the car into the parking lot, but she was startled.
What? How could this old man be Barry's best friend? I've never heard Barry mention him in my life. And why on earth did Barry invite someone to lunch with us? Today of all days.
Barry was waiting at the corner table when Jan and Jones walked in. Quickly it became obvious that they were both coming to the table. Together.
What is this? He wondered. Another surprise from Jan. She brought someone for lunch?
It's that Jones character I've seen around. I cannot believe this. I am not in the mood. Barry stood as the two approached, but it was an odd greeting each gave and received. A married couple in the throes of a divorce, with an old man neither knew, but both thought the other had invited. They ordered crab claws, oyster sandwiches, and iced tea. Jones seemed happy and relaxed. Jan and Barry, each waiting for the other to explain the old man's presence, made tense small talk until they were interrupted a few minutes later by someone who knew them. And Jones. When their mutual friend had gone, Barry looked at Jan beside him, Jones across the table, and said, You know, I don't mean to be rude, but what's going on here?
He's your best friend, Jan retorted. You tell me.
Who's my best friend?
Him, Jan said, indicating Jones.
What? Barry said, not certain if he were more confused or angry. I've never talked to this man in my life. Technically, I suppose that's true, Jones said. But you did wave to me once in the supermarket. And you said hello in church. I've been there several times.
The couple stared incredulously at the old man, not comprehending why he would have deceived him or whether in fact he had.
All in all, however, Jones continued, I still maintain I'm the best friend either of you have. There may be people you've known longer than me. There may be even lots of people you like better than me. But today, Jones said with a wise nod of his head, you don't have a better friend.
Something about this snowy-haired man mesmerized the Hansons, and they sat without speaking as he bit into another crab claw and said,
Most folks figure a true friend is someone who accepts them as they are. But that's dangerous garbage to believe.
He gave a dismissive wave of his hand.
The kid who works the drive-thru at your local fast-food restaurant accepts you for who you are, because he doesn't care anything about you. But a true friend holds you to a higher standard. A true friend brings out the best in you.
Jones cocked his head and leaned across the table as if he were about to tell them a secret.
A best friend, he said softly, will tell you the truth. And a wise best friend will include a healthy dose of perspective.
And we are supposed to do what? Barry asked cautiously.
Just answer a couple of questions, Jones replied, and listen. You'll be able to decide if it's the truth or not.
Jan and Barry exchanged glances, but before either could speak, Jones said,
Now then, you are having marital problems.
Jan's mouth dropped open. Barry leaned forward, shocked, and asked, How could you possibly know that?
Everyone knows, Jones said.
The Hansons looked stricken.
Everyone? Barry gasped. How?
Jones smiled gently.
Because you're married, he said. When you're married, those are the kind of problems you have.
Neither Jan nor Barry knew what to say. What the old man had just stated was so true it was rather silly. In fact, Jan couldn't stop herself from smiling back at Jones.
And your point is? She prompted.
Well, Jones said, seemingly barely suppressing a laugh. I'm not really to the point yet, but if I had to make one now, it'd be for you to understand that all people, all lives, are either in a crisis, coming out of a crisis, or headed for a crisis. And marriage can be a natural extension of that. I wanted you to know that things aren't as bad as they seem. Ever. And in this particular situation, you aren't really that different from a billion other married folks, but as usual, you lack perspective.
You mentioned perspective before, Barry said. What do you mean? Jones looked at the couple thoughtfully for a moment, then without answering Barry, turned to Jan.
Young lady, he began, was your father a good husband to your mother?
Jan frowned.
I don't see what that has to do with... Please, Jones held up his hand. For now, just answer the question, was your father a good husband to your mother?
I think so, yes.
Did he love her?
Yes.
How did he show your mother he loved her?
Jan's eyebrows furrowed.
Well, she began haltingly, he did things for her. What kind of things? Jones asked.
You know, he washed the dishes occasionally. He fixed things around the house. Then setting her jaw and cutting a look at Barry, Jan added, He did things like trimming the shrubbery by the porch so our house would look nice. Jones glanced at Barry and did not smile. He was not at all surprised to see that Jan's comment had gone right over her husband's head.
Young lady, how did this young man, he tilted his head toward Barry, treat you when you were dating? I mean, specifically, how did he show he loved you?
It was as if Jones had turned on a faucet. Barry was wonderful, Jan gushed. He came to my apartment to cook for me many times. He always helped me with the dishes when we ate at home. He fixed things that were broken just like my dad did for my mom. Once Barry even went to my parents' house while they were out of town and mowed their lawn. And it wasn't just those things. I could tell you 100 things he used to do. Suddenly her face fell and her lip began to quiver.
That was when he loved me.
Jan began to cry.
He doesn't understand.
Barry had his eyes closed and was quickly shaking his head.
She is absolutely right, he said. I do not understand, and I admit it.
Then opening his eyes and looking squarely at Jones, he said,
But I love her.
Gazing almost furiously at Jan, he added, I love you. But his eyes instantly flitted back to Jones.
I don't know how many more times a day I could tell this woman that I love her, or that she's beautiful, or that she's great. I gotta tell you, I don't know what to do anymore. This is driving me out of my mind. I didn't sign the papers today, but maybe we should get a divorce.
Jan sobbed audibly and hid her face in her hands. Barry looked embarrassed, suddenly realizing he had been louder than he'd intended, and now a good portion of the restaurant's patrons were glancing nervously toward them. Jones reached across and touched Jan on the shoulder and said quietly to them both,
Let's take a walk.
Both the Hansons were in a daze leaving the restaurant, and neither remembered to pay the check, but a quick smile and a wink from Jones to Nancy at the cash register was all it took to get them out the door quickly. Within a minute they were on the beach, walking east. Jan was no longer crying, but she walked with her head down and arms crossed. Barry looked angry again and asked, "What are we doing here? I have to get back to the bank." Jones continued to walk between the couple and said, "Just a few more minutes. Stay with me for just a bit. Remember," he said as he elbowed the much larger man, "I'm your best friend." Barry shook his head and rolled his eyes. "This is crazy." "Young man," Jones responded, ignoring Barry's irritation, "when you are loved, how do you know it?" "What?" Barry stopped and turned to the old man. "Keep walking," Jones ordered gently. "Answer the question. When a person loves you, when you have felt loved in the past, how has that person expressed that love?" "Well, they told me."
"Told you what?"
"That they loved me."
"Be more specific," Jones prodded.
Barry sighed. "A person who loves me tells me what a good job I have done. They tell me that I look nice. They tell me, you know, that I'm a good man. They tell me they love me." Jones' eyes narrowed.
"Does your wife tell you these things?"
"She used to." Jan spoke up. "He has so many other people telling him this kind of stuff. He doesn't need to hear it from me." Jones ignored her comment and continued to address Barry.
"If she never tells you she loves you, then how have you known all these years that she does?"
"I just assumed it, I suppose," Barry answered, thinking hard. "I guess I thought she loved me because she never left."
"She's leaving now," Jones stated flatly.
Barry stopped and put his hands on his hips. "Where is this going?" Jan had stopped as well, so Jones turned to face them both.
"One more question," he said seriously, "for you both, okay? There has obviously been a lot of water under the bridge. 21 years of experiences, good and bad. If today you could wave a magic wand, save your marriage, and be happy and secure in your love for each other, would you do it?"
Both Barry and Jan, after only a moment's hesitation, but without any sincere hope that it could be accomplished, agreed that, yes, they would save their marriage if it were possible.
"All right, then," Jones said as he smiled and took a deep breath. "Great. Because this is very simple. Your problem is just a matter of perspective."
Barry frowned again and opened his mouth to say something, but Jones wouldn't let him speak.
"Ah," the old man said. "Let me talk now. You listen. From both your points of view, all you can see is a failed marriage. But from where I sit, what I see is simply a failure to communicate. Here's what I mean. You," Jones pointed to Jan, "are from America. And you," he pointed dramatically to Barry, "are from Scotland. Have either of you ever met anyone from Scotland?"
"Yes," Jan said. "I have a cousin who married a guy from Scotland. They live there now."
"Did the man she married speak English?" Jones asked innocently.
"Of course," Jan answered. "Not that it mattered."
"What do you mean?"
"No one could understand him. It was the big family joke one Christmas when they were back in the States."
"Exactly," Jones exclaimed. "And now you will see my point. A person from America speaks the same English as a person from Scotland, but their dialects are so drastically different that often they can't understand each other at all. And you, my friends, are no different. Your language is exactly the same. You both love each other, but your dialects have gotten in the way." "Young lady," Jones said gently to Jan, "your husband does love you. In fact, I believe he loves you very much. But the dialect he uses to communicate it is spoken words of approval. It is also the only dialect he understands. And only by hearing spoken words of approval does he ever feel loved."
I already pointed out how many people already tell Barry how wonderful he is.
Jan answered defensively. "That may be true," Jones said with a wry smile, "and there may be hundreds of those, but the only person who really counts is you. He doesn't love all those other people. He loves you. And only your words of approval can make him feel loved." Seeing the understanding beginning to dawn on Jan's face, Jones felt encouraged to continue. "Unfortunately," he said, "the way we feel loved is usually the same way we express love. Therefore, your husband did everything he could over and over again with the spoken word to tell you how much he loved you. But you never understood because you have not learned the dialect with which he has tried to communicate that love. You see, the dialect you use is one of favors and deeds." Never in their lives, and certainly not in their marriage, had Jan and Barry ever gotten a lightning bolt, but they knew they were receiving one now. Seeing that he had their undivided attention, Jones plowed on with his explanation. "Young man," he said to Barry, "as desperately as she can, your wife has been trying to convey her love to you by doing things for you. She is equally desperate for you to say, 'I love you,' by doing things for her. And because you haven't understood her dialect, those little favors and deeds didn't seem important to you, and she has felt unloved." The Hansons stood with their mouths open. Jan had tears in her eyes. "He's right," she said to Barry. "I never understood. I just thought you didn't do those things for me because you didn't love me."
"I didn't understand either," Barry confessed. "I just didn't know those little favors were that important to you."
"Young man," Jones asked, "would it be possible to learn a new dialect in addition to your own? Is it possible for you to wash a few dishes, cook, or clean occasionally? Maybe trim that holly bush by the front porch?"
"Yes," Barry answered immediately. "Yes, absolutely."
"Young lady," Jones said to Jan, "how about you? Are you willing to learn a new dialect, too? Can you manage a few spoken words of admiration, a few I love yous here and there?"
"Yes, I can. I will," Jan said, not to Jones, but to Barry, who was visibly moved. She put her arms around him and said, "I'm so sorry. I just never knew."
"I'm sorry, too," Barry said.
"And to think we came so close to ending it all."
"And you both loved each other all the time," Jones beamed. "See? You just needed a little perspective."
"You know, sir," Barry said to Jones, still holding Jan tightly, "I do love my wife. I would die for her."
Jones chuckled. "That's fine. But just remember, she doesn't want you to die for her. She just wants you to trim that holly bush."
Jan and Barry tried to engage Jones in more conversation, but he was through talking. Politely refusing their offers of any kind of payment, including food or shelter, he excused himself and continued walking east. The Hansons watched him go, more aware than ever that they knew nothing about the old man, not where he was from or if they would ever see him again.
"Gee, the suitcase," Barry murmured as Jones faded into the distance.
"What about it?" Jan asked.
"I should have at least offered to carry it."
Chapter 3. The sun was shining brightly as Jones ambled up onto the Gulf State Park pier, where I had been waiting. I was sitting on a picnic table, my feet on the bench, nursing a soft drink and watching the fishermen. We greeted each other again and began to talk, mostly about me and my life since he left. It wasn't so much that I wanted only to talk about me, but he was still reticent to discuss himself. Here and there was the answer to where he had been. A lot of things was the response to what he had been doing. In a way, it was frustrating, but I knew better than to push any more than I already had. He declined my invitation to stay at our house, though he congratulated me on having one. Jones pointed underneath the pier, and affecting a serious tone, asked,
"It is nicer than your first place, right?"
Then Jones told me about Jan and Barry.
He wasn't breaking a confidence, he explained, because he was only telling his own part of the story anyway. And besides, he added, they'll be telling everyone what they've learned soon enough. As he laid out the idea behind love expressed in different dialects, I asked if there were more than just the two he had revealed to the Hansons.